Afternoon. Ready to call the third case for today, 00-2036, Ruckel versus Gassner. And standing at the podium is Sheila Sullivan representing Humana.
Good afternoon. My name is Sheila Sullivan, and I represent Humana Incorporated, which is the appellant and the subrogated party in this matter. May it please the court. The facts underlying this case are really quite simple. Justin Ruckel was a guest in the home of Troy Gassner. Mr. Gassner was careless in handling a firearm, and it resulted in a leg injury to Mr. Ruckel. Mr. Ruckel's medical bills for his injury were paid through amounted to $86,000, and they were paid through a self-funded health benefit plan available to Mr. Ruckel's mother through her employer, the School District of Mayville. Humana is the administrator for the school district's self-funded plan. Now, one fact in there, which may not have been sufficiently emphasized in the briefing,
we lifted the podium up. Problems continued, so now we're going to start lowering the podium. That's fine. So we'll see how that does. Sorry to have interrupted you.
Okay. One fact that may not have been sufficiently emphasized in our briefs, and which was entirely overlooked in the amicus brief, but which the court may find significant, is that this was a self-funded plan. Humana is seeking reimbursement for Mr. Ruckel's medical expenses, not for itself, but for the school district of Mayville, which actually provided the funds that paid the medical bills for Mr. Ruckel. And because the school district's health benefit plan was self-funded, any recovery that Humana receives in the lawsuit would go to benefit the taxpayers of the school district of Mayville and not the insurance company.
Counsel, why should that enter into the equation when we're reviewing this issue?
Well, because in response to several of the arguments of the amicus brief, which is that the insurance company is going to take this money and pay it as dividends to its shareholders, and therefore we stand in a more equitable position. I don't think that's true because, in fact, it is taxpayers who are going to be suffering the consequences if this provision is not enforced.
Well, but do you fall into any of the three cases on page 9 of the amicus brief that self-funded plans subject to ERISA? That's the Petro case, workers' comp case, Martinez, medical assistance, the Waukesha County v. Johnson. You don't fall into any of those cases.
No, we do not fall into any of those cases.
I think we should have a separate category for self-funded insurers that go, whose recoveries go to the school fund.
Well, I think it would be appropriate to have a separate category for self-funded plans. That is what is done under federal law. And as the brief pointed out, there are instances in which it's considered appropriate to distinguish between self-funded plans and insurers. And there are many good public policy reasons why that would be the case. For one thing, it makes sense to make Wisconsin law consistent with federal law, because under these ERISA plans, Congress has decided to preempt state regulations with regard to self-funded plans. The United States Supreme Court has made this distinction in FMC Corporation versus Holiday, 498 U.S. 52, and the Wisconsin Court of Appeals addressed it recently in Cavalaris versus MSI Insurance Company, 2001, Wisconsin Appeals 161. Permitting employers to write health benefit plans in in such a way that they can recoup some of their expenses makes it financially more feasible for employers to do this. And we're living in an economic climate where there's a lot of workers who aren't insured, don't have health benefits available through work, and the more financial incentive you give to employers to do this, the more likely it is that they will do it. So in this case, it's a public employer. A lot of times, self-funded plans might be smaller employers. They might only cover a couple dozen employees. And if you have a small group like that, a sum of money that's like the kind that's at stake in this case, $86,000, it's a pretty significant chunk of change, and it may affect the feasibility for the employer of having a plan or not having a plan. And with automatic application of the made whole rule, then you have a large risk that might have to be borne by a very small number of people.
Well, if you had a policy, and if this is the argument that we should have another category, most people don't know, or I shouldn't say what is in their policy. But if you put it up in front and made that you would offer a cheaper policy, understanding this category, in other words, if there is a recovery that we get whatever medicals we paid out, do you think that would make a difference as far as how this court should look at it?
I think it should. A lot of people as individuals might not know whether their plan is self-funded or not, but in this case, I know the plan was the result of a collective bargaining agreement, and many times that is the case. There's a collective bargaining agreement. There's a union working on behalf of the employees, and the terms of the benefit plan could be negotiable. The parties are really on more of an equal footing than in your typical situation where you have just an individual who buys insurance coverage from a large company.
It's clear here that there was language. The language said that an insurance company would get the first subrogation. They get the first X number of dollars. But the point is that do you think it was an issue that was really bargained for? This, in other words, if you put in the beginning of the policy, just note that all employees should be aware of this.
Well, I don't know whether Mr. Ruckel read the policy or not, or whether his mother read the policy or not, and whether that was a factor in her considering employment with the school district. But
well, because this is a policy question, see that. The contract says this, so to stay with the make-whole doctrine, the Rhymes case, the court would be, quote, overlooking or avoiding the language of the policy. And one of the reasons that, remember we had a case here involving the ski hill liability where the question was the language was not in a place where the ordinary person or even the people negotiating for this would have looked for it, would not have known about it.
Well, whether or not someone reads a contract, if they are accepting the benefits of that contract, if the employees are accepting medical payments that are made by the employer, then they, to some extent, are bound by what's in that contract.
Ms. Sullivan, I guess I'm having some trouble understanding why Rhymes doesn't just take care of this case. My understanding, sequence-wise, is that first we've got Garrity, that you've got some language that you've argued from in your brief in Garrity, but then subsequent to Garrity, we've got Rhymes. And Rhymes seems to make it very clear that we apply equity principles. It seems to make it very clear that if someone is going to go unpaid or not fully recover what they should recover, that much better that it be the insurance company rather than the insured. Now, if that's the correct reading of Rhymes, makes your argument? How do you get around that language?
Well, I don't think that Rhymes applies. Rhymes did not address the specific situation. The contract in Rhymes, all it said was, it basically said that the insurance company has a right of subrogation if the insured is paid back through a third party. It didn't address a situation in which there was a contract that had very specific language that said the health plan has the first priority right of recovery. And that's a significant difference because under Wisconsin law, the appropriate analysis is to look first at the language in the contract, and only if the language is ambiguous does the court resort to equitable principles. And there's actually a quote from this court's recent decision in Danbeck that I wanted to read. Danbeck versus American Family Mutual Insurance Company, 2001, Wisconsin 91. Paragraph 10 says that insurance policies construed to give effect to the intent of the parties expressed in the language of the policy itself, which we interpret as a reasonable person in the position of the insured would understand it. Where the language of the policy is plain and unambiguous, we enforce it as written without resort to the rules of construction or principles in case law. This is to avoid rewriting the contract by construction and imposing contract obligations that the parties did not undertake. So, to me, that most important sentence in there is that where the language of the policy is plain and unambiguous, we enforce it as written without resort to the rules of construction or principles of case law. And the made whole doctrine would be a principle in case law that would be considered after the court looks first at the contract language. So I see a two-step analysis there. First, look at the contract language. If that's plain and unambiguous, just enforce it. If there's ambiguity, then you go to the made whole doctrine. And I think that's what Rhymes said. Maybe not so much Rhymes, but Garrity, the court made it clear that they couldn't find any language in the policy that told them what to do, that if there was limited funds available, how are they distributed? And so the court had to have a rule, and it based it on those equitable principles.
And apparently your position would then be that because you've got language in your policy that talks about the fact that the insurance company would have superior rights to the beneficiary, that's what wins out in this case.
Correct. I don't think there's really, it's not necessary to overrule Rhymes. Rhymes would still be applicable in cases where there isn't policy language, where it's ambiguous who gets first priority. But there's no ambiguity in this case.
And, of course, the question is whether you can put language in that all companies would simply insert, you know, language that went into this policy to avoid of the Rhymes case?
Well, under ERISA, that's commonly done. Under ERISA, the health plans do insert that language, and that's expected. In this case, it's a self-funded plan, but not an ERISA plan. If the court were to think that were significant, then a distinction could be made between a self-funded plan and an insured plan. That distinction is made under federal law, and I think it would be consistent for Wisconsin to make that same.
Isn't the usual rule that you can contract unless it's against public policy?
Well, if the legislature feels that a contract is against public policy, especially an insurance contract, the legislature does mandate certain provisions or they prohibit certain provisions.
Well, what does the legislature say about subrogation?
Well, the legislature doesn't address this specific issue. I did outline a couple public policy reasons why it would make sense to distinguish between self-funded and other kinds of plans. Also, as mentioned in the amicus brief, Congress has made an exception in cases in which medical benefits are paid under medical assistance programs.
Well, and why don't you take the position that whether it's self-funded or not, an insurance plan can say we get subrogation first, regardless of the made whole, and that there's nothing in the legislation that says that's contrary to public policy. And you don't like it, don't buy our plan.
Well, I guess we're not asking the court to address that broad of a question today. There is a different balancing of public policy involved when it's a self-funded plan. For example, as I was saying, the medical assistance programs, Congress said, we're going to let them collect first because we want to save the taxpayers some money. And this is another situation here where it would save the taxpayers some money if at least an employer like the School District of Mayville would be able to collect its costs before the insured was allowed to collect his costs.
Counsel, can you help me with this, please? I see the made-whole doctrine as coming from Garrity and as evolves through Rhymes and other cases, and that made-whole doctrine is a part of our Wisconsin common law. Now, common law can be changed by legislation. The question that I have is, can common law be changed by contract?
Well,
is that essentially what you are espousing?
That's essentially what we're saying. The as I read Danbeck, that case says that we're going to look at the language in the contract first. Then if that's if that's ambiguous, we might resort to looking to common law principles. But if the language is plain and unambiguous, we don't need to do that. So that's the way I read it.
Didn't that language in Danbeck speak to rules of construction of a contract, where the construction of the contract is an issue, which is not really the case here? What we're talking about is exactly what Justice Bradley posited, which is the power or ability of parties to contract out of the common law make-whole rule by agreement. We're not talking about contract construction, because it seems to me the contract is plain on its face. But we're talking about whether or not it's permissible, at least in this instance, for parties by agreement to opt out of a common law make-whole rule.
Well, Danbeck's, the question in Danbeck was a construction question, but it did say the court would not apply rules of construction or principles of case law unless the contract was ambiguous. And looking at Rhymes and Garrity, they both applied the equitable principles of subrogation, but they didn't say that it wasn't possible to opt out of that by contract. In fact, Garrity implies that it is possible to do that. And actually, if the court does feel that it's necessary to apply equitable principles, I think that there are equities in this case that favor Humana's position. At least in this case where it's a school district, the amicus brief cites a couple of cases where the court refused to permit subrogation. One was Interstate Fire. And the court refused subrogation in that case because it would have meant that water rates would have gone up in that community where the insurance company was attempting to collect from the water court. In American Insurance Company, the court denied subrogation because it would have led to higher tax burden for the citizens of Milwaukee. And so I think here, where you have a small community like Mayville, where the census tells me in 1990 there were 4,300 people, I'm not sure how many of that is the school district, but you have a small number of people sharing a relatively large burden. So I think that argument can be made that the equities can cut both ways in this case, and that, in fact, under prior case law, they actually tend to cut more in favor of the taxpayer than the individual. And I think, really, the way I see this case, it's more, in fact, a question of just contract interpretation. The language of the policy is plain and unambiguous. That language is cited on page 3 of our brief. If I could just go over it briefly. It says, the beneficiary agrees that by accepting and in return for the payment of covered expenses by the plan, in accordance with the terms of this plan, number one, the plan shall be repaid the full amount of the covered expenses it pays from any amounts received from others for the bodily injuries or losses which necessitated such covered expenses. Number two, the plan's right to repayment is and shall be prior and superior to the right of any other person or entity, including the beneficiary. And number three, the right to recover amounts for injuries or losses which necessitate cover expenses is jointly owned by the plan and the beneficiary. The plan is subrogated to the beneficiary's rights to that extent, regardless of who pursues these rights. The funds recovered shall be used to reimburse the plan as prescribed above. The rights to which the plan is subrogated are and shall be prior and superior to the rights of any other person, including the beneficiary. So the language tells the insurer that the plan will provide health benefits, but that there are strings attached. It puts the insured on notice that if the insured receives payments under that plan and the insured is able to receive a recovery from a third party, then the plan has the right to be reimbursed in full. And it states unambiguously that not once but twice that the plan's rights to repayment are prior and superior to those of the beneficiary. And I think the plaintiff has attempted to make the plan sound ambiguous by taking language out of context, but the clear rule is that insurance policies have to be interpreted as a whole to give reasonable meaning to all of its provisions.
If this plan were governed by ERISA, would that language be sufficient to opt out of any federal common law rule of make-whole?
I think undoubtedly it would be. I deal with a lot of ERISA plans in my practice, and that's the sort of language that we use to enforce our right to be reimbursed. And I might just point out that the effect of having a provision like this is actually, it promotes settlement. It's usually the injured party who pursues the lawsuit, and the subrogated party follows on the coattails of the injured party, and the subrogated party needs the cooperation of that injured person in order to pursue the lawsuit. And what normally happens, since the plaintiff isn't willing to settle a case in which they get nothing, is that the subrogated party and the plaintiff actually end up reaching some sort of settlement where they each get some money. So the plaintiff isn't quite made whole, the insurance company isn't fully reimbursed, but they each are equally unhappy.
Counsel, made whole is part of subrogation. Subrogation is equitable principles. Is it your position that a contract may modify this equitable principle to any extent that it wants to?
Well, there's going to be some limit. There's a quote in one of the briefs. I forget the language. I forget exactly which brief it is, but it says that basically it can't be a result of misrepresentation, fraud, overreaching, and something else.
Well, that goes beyond this equity necessarily. I mean, subrogation is made whole is all part of equity, right?
Correct.
Seems to me that even if you assume the premise that it can be modified, that the common law can be modified by contract, that there may be limitations on contract short of fraud and misrepresentation as it goes to equity.
I think that would kind of fall in the category of overreaching. And since this sort of provision is very common in ERISA plans, it would not be something that it would be inequitable to enforce because many, many employees are covered by ERISA plans and they're subject to the made whole rule. And so to me, it's just to extend it to this case is not inequitable. I think my time is almost up. Are there any more?
You have until the red light. It's about 2 or 3 minutes, I'd say, but you don't feel obliged to use it. But if you like, it's there.
I have a question, a further question. Is there any difference from a public policy standpoint between ERISA plans, which federal law says the parties can opt out of make whole by agreement so long as they do so clearly and unambiguously, and these sorts of plans? You touched on this briefly at the outset of your argument, but if you could develop that. In an ERISA plan, subrogation goes back into the pool, right? Any monies recovered on a subrogation claim by the plan go back to the plan, which exists for the benefit of all the employees.
Right.
Which is not what we have here. It's going back to the employer.
Right.
Which, granted, is a public entity and exists to serve the taxpayers and the community, but, you know, it's a different situation qualitatively from ERISA plans, isn't it?
I don't see the difference. Basically, Congress said if we have an ERISA plan and there's a small group that's sharing the burden, the risk here through the self-funded plans, that we think that it's fair to let them collect whatever they can from third parties if the parties opt to do that in their contract. And so I think the same principle applies. Whether or not it's a ERISA plan, you have a small employer, money is an issue, affordability of health plans is an issue, and when you have a small number of employees spreading a huge amount of risk among them is not really possible because the risk falls on a small number of people.
Thank you. Ms. Sullivan, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Before we start your argument, Mr. Dunphy, we're going to try and make an adjustment to the sound system. Dunphy, representing the plaintiffs and the amicus curiae, you filed with for the Academy of Trial Lawyers and have been given permission to argue this.
That's good.
Mr. Stork, welcome.
Thank you very much. May it please the court. The question that was certified to the court is whether the made whole doctrine applies when an insurance contract specifically states that the insurer's subrogation rights are superior to the beneficiary's right to be made whole. I'm prepared to address that question. The answer is Yes, the doctrine still applies. Made whole applies in all situations in which the insurer asserts subrogation rights regardless of what the insurance contract says about priority. Whether created by common law or contract, subrogation is an equitable doctrine intended to prevent unjust enrichment of an insured. That's what the law is in the state of Wisconsin and has been for decades. Made whole is the essence of subrogation. Why do I say that? Because by definition, an insurance company's subrogation rights do not exist until the insured has been made whole, because unjust enrichment or double recovery, which was the phrase used in the Rimes decision, unjust enrichment and double recovery does not occur. And the right, until that occurs, rather, the right of subrogation does not exist under common law. So a subrogation clause that eliminates the made whole doctrine, eliminates the very equities on which the insurance company's claim is based. If an insurance company is allowed a priority right to third-party payments, the doctrine of subrogation will be literally turned on its head. It will not prevent unjust enrichment by the insured, which is its intent. Instead, it will guarantee double payment, double recovery for unjust enrichment to the insurer.
Run through that with me. So in this case, the insurer, we've been told, is the money would be going back to the taxpayers of Mayville, supposedly. So where is the double recovery?
Because they have been assessed a premium for the medical payments that they have made.
This is what I want to ask. I asked the opposing counsel a similar question. If that assessment is based upon the fact that they're going to get the first, they're going to get their med pay back, $8,000, and you have a lower rate paid, how does that fit into the unjust or the double recovery?
Well, first, this record doesn't show that that, in fact, is the basis for assessing the premium or the assessment. Secondly, even assuming that bottom line is that market rates, premium charges, are based upon the actuarially anticipated and assessed risk. It is not possible to assess how many third-party recoveries there will be in any given contract term. It is not possible to actuarially anticipate how much money, if any amount, will be recovered as a result of subrogation payments.
Oh, that is a matter of fact. That's what I was not sure. I don't know. I know it's not just looking at this case, whether there ever could be something written in the seems brief that was filed said, no, you never can, and we should file a Rimes. All I'm asking is, well, if you put it up in front and you had a special type of policy, and you're saying, no, you cannot assess that risk, there's no way from an actuarial standpoint doing that.
That's right. In fact, I would suggest to the court that premium rates and charges for medical benefits are based upon the stock market's rate of return on the company's portfolio, as well as the cost of medical care and the method and manner in which it rises. I would point the court out to Lee versus Threshermith, which is a 1964 case, 26 Wis Second 361. It says, quote, another characteristic of subrogation is that it is employed to avoid unjust enrichment. Consequently, in the absence of unjust enrichment, there is no basis for invoking the doctrine.
Was that case talking about equitable subrogation or contractual subrogation?
Actually, it's even before Rhines and before Garrity. It's a 1964 decision that dealt with mortgages. The point is that it is consistent with cases going back to 1907, Hughes versus Thomas, which is cited in the Rock River case that we have in our brief. American Insurance, Garrity, Rhines, Lee, all of these cases, Hamilton, that's the 1931 case, all of these cases stand for the proposition that the very nature of subrogation is a right that arises only once there has been unjust enrichment.
And it's unjust enrichment of the insured.
Absolutely.
That's why it's vacuum.
So exactly.
So it's not unjust enrichment of the insurance company.
No, that would turn subrogation on its head. If we give a priority right to the self-funded plan in this case, if we allow a contract to give a priority rate, a priority position to the insurance company, what we have done is say that the right of subrogation exists before there's been the very triggering event for the right. That's why contractually you can't give a priority right of subrogation to the health insurance company. You can't create by contract. You can't contract away a right that doesn't exist. And the right of subrogation does not exist until there has been an unjust enrichment or a double recovery by the insured.
If that's the case, there's an awful lot of attorneys out there who are writing these plans with precisely the opposite assumption, that it is possible to contract out of the make-whole rule, right, by specifying priorities?
I have not run across this type of policy provision absent an ERISA plan.
Okay.
Now, I think it's an important question that was raised by this board and one I feel I should address. Why do we have ERISA? Why do we have the medical assistance payback rights?
Or workers' comp.
And workers' comp. All three of these were created by statute. Why were they created by statute? Because they were not entitled to that money, any of those entities, under common law. It was left to the legislature to make a decision that we will create a right that does not exist in common law. Parties to a contract cannot negotiate for a right that doesn't exist.
Well, make whole under ERISA is not statutory, right? That's judge made.
Under the ERISA law, the federal law, a priority right, if the contract is written properly, the self-funded plan does in fact have a priority right to the individual plan member. But that right was created, given to the self-funded plan by legislative act, and then it's up to the self-funded plan to decide whether they're going to exercise that right and to put it in the contract. They couldn't do that without the federal legislation authorizing them to do so. And that's why we have different, a difference here in a private contract versus legislatively created payback rights.
You know, what's your position? That only if it's authorized by the legislature can priority?
Yes.
Your position, and why? Is it contrary to public policy? It's not contrary to a statute, right?
It is not contrary to statute. Statute okay. Doesn't deal with it.
So what law is it contrary to? Because otherwise the rule is you can contract unless it violates a statute or a constitution or public policy, right?
Yes, but you'd be creating by contract. You're contracting away a right that doesn't exist. Subrogation law says that there is no right of subrogation in the insurance company until and unless the insured has been made whole. So how can you give a priority right?
But that's court-made law.
That's true.
So if it's court-made law, then the court can say, accept. You may contract.
This court could decide to change the common law.
Okay.
Been making common law long before I came on the scene. Yes, you could do that. But in order to do that in this case, you would have to rewrite the common law of subrogation as it's existed in Wisconsin, as far back as the doctrine has been interpreted.
Not every state has a make-whole doctrine for subrogation, right?
I assume not, simply because, although I can't represent that to the court, I haven't read what all 50 states have done.
Counsel, how do you deal with the language in Garrity? The holding, I guess, is the last paragraph. We hold that because the contract here contains no language to the contrary, then the normal rules of subrogation apply, and the subrogee has no right to share in the funds recovered by the tortfeasor until the subrogor is made whole. I mean, I think you can take that language and argue, if you want to talk common law, they're saying normal rule is made whole unless the contract here contains no language to the contrary. And, of course, that's what your opposing counsel is arguing.
That was not the ruling of Garrity. If you look at Garrity, what happened in Garrity is there was a subrogation clause in the contract. In addition, there was a subrogation receipt. The Garrity court took a look at the question of made whole. They said under the common law, there is no right of subrogation until the insured has been made whole. Now let's take a look at the language in the insurance contract and in the subrogation receipt and decide whether it conflicts with the common law. The Garrity court went on to say that that policy language, the contractual language, did not conflict with common law. That was the end of the ruling. The fact that they may have gone on and said, but gee, if it had, but that would be a different question that had not been raised before the court and wasn't addressed by the court.
It's the last paragraph, it's one sentence, and it says, we hold. It sounds to me like it's the holding of the case.
But it really didn't go to the question. When the court rejected it, it said these insurance clauses do not violate common law. So they never ruled on it. And if there was any doubt about that, I'd point the court to two cases. First, Rhymes. If there's any doubt, it's over. But secondly, I think this is rather interesting, is that in Rhymes, and again in Ives, Justice Steinman's concurring, the concurring opinion in Ives stated, this is not a valid basis to support the holding in Garrity, which allows courts to ignore existing contracts under the guise of the common law. So certainly the concurrence authored by Justice Steinman looked at Garrity and said it allows the courts to ignore existing contracts under the guise of the common law. So I think between Rhymes and one in the concurrence in Ives, the court certainly has looked at it from that standpoint. I also think from public policy standpoint that the consequences of enforcing a priority right should be considered. In all practicality, after doing this for over a quarter of a century now, you're going to turn cases for people who are injured, whether seriously or not, you're going to turn them into collection actions for the insurers who have already been paid a premium for the benefits they are paying on behalf of that injured person. Whether it's a $25,000 minimum liability policy that's available in a multiple injury collision, there will be, if there's $25,000 to $30,000 in medical expenses, which is not uncommon in today's environment, then there is no third-party recovery by the insured who was injured. And that's the very basis for the subrogation doctrine, just third-party payments to the injured person. The more egregious cases are even more apparent, whether you've had a spinal cord injury or brain damage, and represent those type of people who I have had the privilege of representing over the years. 100 to 150 to 250,000 in medical expenses is not uncommon. $100,000 insurance policy on the other side is not uncommon. If you enforce this contract, that is certainly not equitable, because the company that has been paid a risk, paid for the risk, assessed the cost of that risk, will now have the priority to the very significantly limited funds. I would conclude, unless there are more questions, the basis for subrogation has often been said, let the insurance company step into the shoes of the insured for purposes of recovering benefits from the third party tortfeasor. If a priority right is given to the insurance company by contract, I would respectfully suggest that not only would that company step into the shoes of the insured, but they would be entitled to take the shirt off his back, to clean out his closet, and reserve the right to raise next year's premium. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Dunphy. Ms. Sullivan?
I see the general rule in Wisconsin. The general rule is that the court looks at the plain language of the contract and enforces that plain language if it's unambiguous. It's only where there's ambiguity in the contract that the court resorts to rules of construction and principles such as the made whole doctrine. I believe the trial court erred in this case when it applied the made whole rule without first considering the plain language of the health benefit plan provided by the school district of Mayville.
I don't think it's the plaintiff's position that there's an ambiguity here. The plaintiff, I think, is arguing that this contract clause cannot be enforced because it conflicts with the common law make whole rule. I think that. We should not enforce this contract, and courts should be prohibited from enforcing contracts such as this, or clauses such as this, that attempt to opt out of the make-whole rule because it's inconsistent with the common law of make-whole.
And, well, in one of the briefs, the plaintiff did say that it was ambiguous, but I guess my main point is that I think the court should look to the contract language, and before resorting to equitable, the doctrine of equitable subrogation, I don't see a reason why why a contract can't be reached between parties. Here you have employers and employees who reach an agreement. The employer agrees to provide health benefits under certain conditions. One of those conditions is that if the employee is able to be reimbursed for medical expenses that the employee agrees then to reimburse the employer. That to me sounds like a perfectly reasonable contract provision. Did Justice Wilcox have a question?
What about the plaintiff's argument that subrogation does not even arise, a right of subrogation, either equitably or by law because of the contract until there has been a double recovery? In other words, until the plaintiff has been made whole. In other words, it's just a contingent right, whatever its source, the contract or equitable principles, and so it doesn't come into play until there's been that situation of double recovery.
Well, that was the original underpinning for the made whole doctrine. When the court was faced with a situation where the plaintiff had a right to recover damages and the insurance company had a right subrogation, and the court was faced with a situation where there's limited funds, and the court had to prioritize, make a rule. But I don't see anything in case law that says that parties can't agree to a contract provision in which they decide amongst themselves that the employer does have the right of subrogation and that the employer has first priority right to repayment. And one final point that Mr. Dunphy made that I'd like to address is that, as I said before, the practical effect of the made whole of the preemption of the made whole doctrine under ERISA plans has been that the parties reach a settlement in which the injured party gets some money and the insurance company gets some money. And so I don't think the effect of preempting the made whole doctrine is going to be that that the injured party is never going to get anything. They're probably going to get somewhat less than if the made whole doctrine applied, but they will get something in almost every instance where funds are available from the tortfeasor. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Sullivan. I want to say on behalf of the court that we postpone the hearing from 1:45 to 2 because our morning session ran longer. I apologize. On behalf of the court for you all waiting. So thank you to Ms. Sullivan and Mr. Dunphy and you, Mr. Storm, for excellent arguments. And with that, we are... this hearing is closed, and we are in recess until tomorrow.